This is Fresh Air. I'm Artie Moskowain in for Terry Gross. As the best friends of men and women, dogs live complicated lives. Like humans, they need food and shelter and a loving relationship. And like humans, they can develop behavioral problems because of the environment they live in and because of their lineage. When those behavior problems become unmanageable, dog owners often turn to people like Nicholas Dodman. He's director of the Behavior Clinic at Tufts University School of Veterinary Medicine, where he's also a professor of behavioral pharmacology. Dodman researches the effects of drugs like Prozac and phenobarbital on aggressiveness, anxiety, and obsessive compulsiveness in dogs. His new book about his work is called The Dog Who Loved Too Much. Let's begin with behavior modification. I asked Dodman what theories he applies in his work with canine clients.
Well, one of the fundamental sort of underpinnings of sort of the clinical science of animal behavior modification is the study of ethology, which started years ago with sort of famous ethologists who studied the natural behavior of all sorts of species in the wild, you know, including the dog. And from that work, we learned what dogs would normally do and how they would communicate, you know, and how they signal to each other, and reproductive behavior, you know, what sort of form that takes, and courting behavior and all these sort of things. And from the study of the natural behavior in the wild, you can extrapolate to the sort of the wolf in your living room. But also, the science is based on studies in psychology, studies of learning and thoughts of motivation and so on, as well as that. So this is how we can modify the patterns that we see.
I'm curious that if somebody brings a dog to you, let's say this is a dog that chews everything in sight, how do you begin the process of diagnosis?
Well, the people are often a little concerned when they come to us because they, you know, they worry in case, you know, they're going to be psychoanalyzed, or in case we're going to put the dog on a couch and try communicating with it or some such. But it's really quite a matter-of-fact-ish type approach that we have the owner and the dog come into our consulting room, and they sit down and we ask them a series of questions which relate to their dog's, actually every aspect of the dog's life from the moment it was born until the present time, focusing particularly on background things like exercise, diet, level of communication, obedience training, if you like, how obedient the dog is. Also, the specific problem, events which appear to trigger the problem, and how the animal behaves immediately prior to the actual problem, what happens during the event, what happens afterwards, things the owners have tried to modify it, and so on. And the whole thing culminates in a diagnosis, just like in regular veterinary medicine.
Is there something embarrassing about bringing a dog to a behavior therapist?
It appears so. You know, I mean, it seems that women are more open to this than men. I mean, that's the way it appears to me. Quite often, it's a woman that brings the animal in, and she might bring her husband in tow, who sometimes looks a little sheepish and sits quietly until, you know, they understand what we're doing, and that it's a sort of, it's a science that we're practicing. And once it becomes more rational, then they join in, but they're very concerned to start with. At least it would be something more curious.
How much, though, do you look at what the dog's owners do, look at the way that they treat the dog, the perhaps mixed signals they might give the dog? I'm thinking oftentimes when children are brought into a therapist, a child exhibiting behavior problems, oftentimes that's a signal that there might be something wrong within the family. Do you approach it that way too?
We do. We do regard the problem that exists as what is termed a dyadic in nature, which means that it involves two components. It involves, you know, oftentimes one person or the family and the dog. So it's kind of an interactive problem. And sometimes the dog's actually doing something entirely normal, but it's not, it's not to the owner's liking. So that becomes a problem, even though the dog is not actually doing anything abnormal for its species. Other times, the dog is doing something abnormal, but the owner's reaction feeds into the problem, making it worse often. That's why we see them, and we try and change that interaction so that the behavior gradually becomes better.
Well, let's talk a little bit about aggression. You say this is the number one behavior problem, and aggression can exhibit itself in many different kinds of ways. But you talk about a Rottweiler named Rocky. What was his problem?
His problem was dominance-related aggression, which is the most common behavior problem that I see, and it's also the most common behavior problem in dogs, according to all of the published work. So it probably comprises about 50% of any behaviorist caseload, and essentially, you know, in a nutshell, is aggression towards family members or literally biting the hand that feeds. It stems from the dog's pack mentality and their natural drive, at least not all dogs, but ones with an inherited dominant drive to move upwards through the pack, pushing all aside ahead of them unless they reach a stopping point, which should be an authoritative human being. And this is where we find that owners can unwittingly contribute to propagating this behavior because they interpret the dog's behavior differently and respond with kindness and a sort of really softness, which actually leads to more of that type of behavior.
And the problem with Rocky was that the wife, there was a husband and wife couple that brought Rocky in. The husband was able to deal with him quite well, but he began to bite the wife. Now, what was he saying? What was the meaning of his behavior?
Well, dominance is relative, like all things are supposed to be these days. And, it depends on the relationship of the dog, which is dominant, with each individual that it comes in contact with, whether that's a person or a dog. And in terms of Rocky, as far as his male owner was concerned, this male owner, by his body language and behavior, had managed to transmit to Rocky that he was clearly in charge. And as far as the woman was concerned, who was reacting with sort of kindness and tenderness in situations where perhaps she should have taken a firmer line, she ended up by being the subject of considerable unwanted aggression from Rocky. So it was a complete dichotomy, just total zero aggression to the man, and the woman, really, it was almost a kind of an abusive situation.
So if we're looking at pack behavior, Rocky was working his way up to the top of the pack, and he had to get her out of the way. Is that right?
Well, he doesn't really... He just was number two in that pack. So the man was number one, and he was number two, and the woman was number three. So the man could get away with murder, and the poor woman could do nothing. So the job in that case was to try and I could not change her personality, but what I could do is I could change the way that she interacted with Rocky in order to sort of generate some respect from him. It's almost like the old Stanley Dangerfield thing, you know, can't get no respect. So we try and increase their authority by just different ways that they interact. And essentially, it's just taking a firm line. It doesn't mean being unkind. It just means setting limits and following through and doing what you intend to do.
So specifically, what did you have the woman do?
There's a series of steps. At the moment, there are nine. I'm hoping to add one to it to make it the 10 steps. But it starts off with we insist that people do not confront their dog. If you confront a dominant dog, they're likely to get more aggressive and you can get into serious trouble, at least the clients we see who arrive at us really as a last resort. And these dogs are usually pretty bad players. And if we have them start to, you know, yank on a collar or force them into a down position or yell at them, they would probably get bitten. So no confrontation is the number one golden rule. And number two, we have them work on obedience. And number three, we have them make the dog work for everything that it wants. So the name of the program is, some people call it Nothing in Life is Free, some people call it Working for a Living, and another good term is No Free Lunch. So everything that dog wants, whether it's food, praise, toys, exercise, or freedom, it must do something first before it receives those wonderful things from its owner. And the owner does control the resources and can control the dog's behavior in that way. And the program is pretty successful if the owners understand it, follow through.
One of the things you talk about in dealing with dogs with aggressive problems is don't pet indiscriminately. Why not?
Well, that's true. And really, the reason is that you will intimidate almost any type of dog. So, for example, if you take a dominant dog like Rocky and you walk up and you pet him on the head, contrary to what most people think, dogs like us don't like to be patted on the head. You know, a far less threatening thing to do is to pet them, you know, between their front legs and their chest. And a little gentle scratch there is much more appropriate and appreciated much more. Or to stroke the hair gently, the direction that it grows in on the side of the head. Petting on the head or patting on the head is just not appreciated. A dominant dog has a good chance of growling or biting you. And because that particular gesture of a hand coming down from above over the head is construed as, you know, a dominant or, you know, for a dominant dog, a subordinate gesture by the approaching human, because of the threatening nature of it, a fearful dog will also react, especially if it's in a tight corner, by biting you out of fear. And essentially the message there is they're trying to drive the bogeyman away.
Nicholas Dodman works with dogs with behavior problems at Tufts University. His book is called The Dog Who Loved Too Much. We'll talk more after a short break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to dog behaviorist and researcher Nicholas Dodman. When do you decide that you need to intervene medically? And this is something that you're doing research in, and you use what we consider to be psychiatric medications to deal with certain canine behavior problems?
It depends on the condition. You know, if I was dealing with dominance aggression, I would probably try and manage without medicine in the first instance because the programs work reasonably well. Only if the behavior was refractory to treatment, if it was a kind of a low responder, or if I wanted a more broad spectrum effect, would I start suggesting to the owners that they would use behavior modifying drugs. If you talk about conditions in the fear spectrum, once again, most simple fears do respond well to desensitization programs, so we would attempt that first with the appropriate background modification of diet and exercise and communication through obedience training. But with a fearful condition, we wouldn't really hesitate to use very, safe and specific medicine to sort of, I call it like the pharmacological shoehorn, just to grease or lubricate the desensitization program. But in the last category of behavior problems, which are the compulsive behaviors, with them, I would probably be recommending that they medicate these dogs right off the bat, even though there is some other serious environmental and behavior modification advice that goes along with that.
What kind of medication do you use then for a dog that has a dominance aggression problem? What drugs do you turn to?
Drugs that work on that famous basic neurotransmitter, neuromodulator, serotonin. Mm-hmm. People throw their arms up in amazement when you mention the name Prozac, but Prozac and the Prozac family, which have a serotonin enhancing effect, we did just show recently in a scientific study, statistically analyzed and otherwise proven, that in fact there is a decrease in dominance aggression when dogs are treated with Prozac, and sometimes I believe that can be a very useful effect, either to complement behavior modification therapy or in some other instances, perhaps even without behavior modification therapy. It depends a lot on the circumstances.
Do you see side effects when using something like Prozac on a dog?
We do. We sometimes see a decrease in appetite, in weeks 2, 3, or 4 of treatment. It's usually transient, but it does have a slight effect of reducing hunger, and we also sometimes see a little bit of what a colleague of mine calls loginess. You know, they become a little bit more lethargic. Not always, but a percentage of them will go that way. And I have heard one or two owners saying they thought their animals actually a little bit more alert and active and perhaps barked a little more, which is the equivalent of humans who get agitated when they're first put onto Prozac. So we sort of see the same spectrum of side effects as you see with Prozac in people.
And does Prozac work in dogs the way it works with people? Work on their brain and central nervous system?
Well, yes. You know, and I think that people somehow imagine that dogs are, you know, tremendously different from people because they walk on all fours and they're furry all over. But as a matter of fact, you know, their brains are very similar. They have all the same landmarks there. They have a fewer corrugations in their cerebral cortex and perhaps don't rely on that as heavily as we do. Not so cognitively endowed, but essentially it's just shades of gray, and the cells are the same, and the connections are the same, and the neurotransmitters are the same. So it really comes as no surprise to a biologist to find that a drug like serotonin has exactly the same effects in a dog as it has in people.
Do you want to eventually wean a dog from Prozac? Do you think there's any danger in keeping them on Prozac for their behavior for the rest of their life?
I don't believe there is at this point. I think it's always untrue to say I don't think there's any danger, but we have had animals, dogs and cats, on Prozac or Prozac-like medication for some years now, and people have been on Prozac for sort of 7 or 9 years or something, and so far there don't seem to be any serious long-term side effects. So it does seem to be safe in the long term, and it's considerably safer, as I just mentioned, than anything that's gone before. Veterinarians were prescribing acepromazine, which is a phenothiazine tranquilizer with antihistaminic action. That is essentially a sedative. They were prescribing synthetic progesterone-like substances, which cause considerable depression and organ damage. They were prescribing phenobarbital, which is just a CNS depressant, and it's not specifically dealing with the behavior problem at all. They were prescribing Valium with gay abandon, which is addictive and has some very nasty effects in cats and as well as dogs, as well as increasing appetite and turning them into a couch potato. So there's been some very nasty things that have gone before, but nothing has ever attracted as much attention as Prozac, which is safer and more specific than the rest put together.
Is there any danger in using a human solution, and by that I mean drugs like Prozac for animal problems? If dogs are really being asked to live in a human world, and yes, they've been domesticated, but there still must be some wild genes at work there, is it asking too much of them?
I don't think that the solution to the behavior problems that dogs exhibit should be thought of as something which is simply fixed with a pill. I think that it requires a much more broad spectrum effect. I think it is important for us to get the attention of the AKC and to insist on better breeding, including breeding for temperament and tests for temperament that would encourage people to produce basically better dogs. I think it's important to educate people to know how to socialize and raise puppies so that they don't dig a hole for themselves and end up with behavior problems that subsequently need to be treated. I think it's important to educate people about environmental enrichment so that they realize that a dog is not like a lawn tractor that you park and go away to work and come back and it's just still sitting there waiting for you to turn the key. I think it's important to make sure dogs are fed properly and exercise properly and that you communicate properly and you do everything you can do. And if you have a problem, I think it's important to engage whatever behavior modification programs are appropriate, and there are different ones for different occasions, to solve that problem. And somewhere down that line of chain of events, if to turn a dog around permanently, you require to facilitate that by giving, for example, a beta blocker like propranolol to a nervous dog to facilitate desensitization, or if you require to give a dog with compulsive licking a drug like Prozac to stop that compulsive licking and perhaps save it from losing a leg, then I think that's an appropriate adjunct to a behavior modification therapy.
Nicholas Dodman is director of the Behavior Clinic at Tufts University School of Veterinary Medicine, where he's also a professor of behavioral pharmacology. His book is called The Dog Who Loved Too Much. Tomorrow on Fresh Air, we continue our conversation with Dr. Dodman, focusing on separation anxiety and obsessive compulsive disorders in dogs. This is Fresh Air.